My name is Kevin Cahill. I have had several occupations, if you like, but mainly journalism. I was the deputy editor of the Sunday Times Rich List long ago, and I was also an advisor in the House of Lords on surveillance.
So that second job there, that sounds fascinating. And how much power do the Lords actually have? What were you doing there?
Well, I was advising individually. It's the way it works. They don't have a job like a surveillance advisor, but you persuade some members of the Lords to take you on. So I was a staff member, and I was advising them on surveillance because a lot of my background dealt with surveillance. One of the people I was advisor to much earlier was Paddy Ashdown, who was the MI6 station chief in Switzerland.
Oh, I didn't.
And a Royalman.
I don't know that about Ashdown.
I was his when he first came to Parliament in 1983. He picked up on my stories and he asked me to join him. And a friend of mine told me that he was the MI6 station chief, the guy I was at school with. Because when you're in the embassy, they all reveal themselves to each other, the friendlies anyway. So, of course, Paddy was disclosed himself to the Irish embassy. And I had a friend who was at school with me. So he said, "Your boss in the House of Commons is a former spook."
So was he bringing you as a journalist in to keep an eye on you?
No, not at all. The opposite.
No, to you, useful advice.
Yeah. Our beloved ally, the United States, was busy playing hooky with our high tech. And Paddy thought that was wrong.
So what were the Americans up to?
They were making it impossible for UK companies to export computers they were buying from America.
Well, you know, weren't we manufacturing our own computers, though, Kevin?
No, we weren't. We haven't manufactured a computer since about late 1960s.
Really? What about ICL? What were they doing?
Making second-hand copies of American... Well, no, they were trying to make copies of Japanese machines, and it just got too expensive.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, that, you know, it seemed so, even back in those days, so dependent on the Americans. But anyway, can you just tell us about your latest exploits? Because I know you're doing some legal challenges about surveillance, particularly in the UK and Europe.
Yeah. Well, go back to your question. What did I do in the Lords? I used to run a lot of conferences, which were never reported by anybody, including The Guardian. And I would tell the peers what was going on, which they weren't being told by the government. You know, the government was lying through its teeth. And the peers I worked for would periodically, you know, raise issues, raise questions. And it blew up when Edward Snowden, in 2013, made all those revelations about what the Americans were really up to. And they were spying in the House of Parliament, Microsoft were. Now, this is a matter of public record. In September 2007, the National Security Agency and Microsoft jointly imposed mass surveillance in the United Kingdom. It's in the legal record. It was a judgment in an Irish court, and then it was the judgment of the European Court of Justice. So, you know, there's no kind of factual argument. This is what they were doing. And nobody did anything. The Information Commissioner, you know, who was on the side of the surveillance parties, never brought a complaint against any of the people named by the courts as doing this criminal surveillance. I mean, the guy who is officially responsible for looking at surveillance, the information, what was it called, the information, not the information, the Investigatory Powers Commissioner, was a very senior high court judge, he looked at it and he said it was criminal. And nobody did anything. Nothing.
Well, that's a bit worrying, isn't it, if certain crimes are not being punished? It sounds like the criminal justice system isn't really doing its job.
In that case, well, I got a case. I'm not a lawyer, as you know. It's one of the things I didn't do. I got a case before the High Court, before the court that this the Investigatory Powers Commissioner sort of head off, and my case was heard. No problem. And the court said, fine, what do you want to do? The judge said. And I said, he said, what do you want me to do? Can I issue an invitation to the cops and to the information commissioner to investigate this? And I said, that would be marvelous, sir, your honor. And that's what he did. The court issued an invitation to two police forces and to the information commissioner saying, investigate this. And all three of them told the court to, if you'll excuse the French, bugger off. Contempt of court. The Devon and Cornwall police said, go away. And the Metropolitan Police, they actually, Hogan Howe actually wrote a letter that it effectively said, go away. We're not going to investigate. And then the information commissioner was even more abusive. The information commissioner was actually abusive about it. You know, I got an email saying you're doing the wrong thing and you shouldn't be doing this and all this kind of rubbish. But against the odds, back in those days, GCHQ criticized the American companies in a really savage article in the Financial Times. The head guy at GCHQ said, this is all wrong, and what you're doing is aiding terrorists and dirty-do. And nothing happened.
So I bet he didn't last long.
He did not, and he never got his knighthood either. But he knew that was the risk.
Anyway, so what is this latest action you're taking?
Well, the European Parliament, which has no influence in the UK now, but I am still a European EU citizen, the European Parliament actually published, wait for this, a petition on my behalf in October last year, saying, yes, this mass surveillance is going on. And the petition was really carefully framed. It said, this is how it is going on. You know, it set out how you would sue if you had the money. So the European Parliament unanimously passed my petition saying this is still going on and it's still wrong and something needs to be done about it, but nothing's happened. So I've gone back to the case, the old case, yeah? The one where the judge said to the police, you must investigate, you must look at this.
Yeah, what year was that though? When was that?
2015.
Okay.
But it's still an open case because the defendants, the two police forces and the information commissioner, rejected the court's invitation. So it's an open case. So I think I better frame it very carefully. I have given the court preliminary notice that I'm coming back to ask them to change the word invitation to an order. In other words, for the court to order the police to investigate and to order the information commissioner to investigate. But I've, as you probably know, in the meantime, I've sued various of these criminals in the small claims court. And the small claims judges have misdirected themselves. They've thrown out parliamentary evidence.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting aspect of journalism, isn't it? Because maybe you can take us back to Fleet Street, where these sorts of legal actions were kind of normal in Fleet Street in order to tease information out. It seems to happen very rarely now.
It's not done by... the great exponent of legal action to get the facts was Harry Evans. Do you remember Harry Evans? the great editor of the Sunday Times, the one who made it famous.
No, not really. Maybe before my
time. Before your time. Harry spent 30% of his time in court as an editor of the Sunday Times. He spent 30% of his time sitting in court arguing to get facts out of the government. Thalidomide was his great case. But again, that was when the paper was owned by the Thompsons. And it cost, Harry must have spent the equivalent of millions, especially on the Thalidomide case. I mean, he was in the High Court, the Appeal Court. I think he even went to the Supreme Court. And each of those steps cost you $200,000 or $300,000.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that, actually, as any citizen can do this if they really wish to. I mean, even if you're not a journalist, you're not an editor of a national newspaper, you can still take court actions which might actually reveal some fascinating facts. A bit like the people are quite used to doing these freedom of information requests, but not actually going to the court system itself.
But this is where we fall, where we hit. The Attorney General now, Suella Braverman, she is trying to cut off all access to the courts for anybody. She is in the process of abolishing the Human Rights Act. And you couldn't make this up. The chief executive in her office, who's writing this alleged Bill of Rights, is the former legal director of GCHQ. A man entirely on the side of people who want to exercise their rights.
Yeah, right.
He was the successor. He wasn't in GCHQ when, if you like,
Look,
GCHQ.
Before, I mean, the Human Rights Act wasn't even in force when Harry was doing his stuff. There's a lot more scope, really, for journalists and citizens to be taking these sort of matters to court like you're doing. Can you just take us through the basics? Which court do you go to? How do you do it?
Okay, if you're not rich and you haven't got lots of money, the court you have to go to is the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. It's part of the High Court of England and Wales, so it's a proper part of the High Court. But the magic thing about it is you don't have to pay costs. It's free. And certainly when they heard my case, they did something normal-ish, but they heard it ex parte. They didn't allow the other people, the two police forces and the human rights, the information commissioner, to come into the court and argue the case. You know, the two judges sat there and listened to it and decided themselves what to do, and they didn't invite the others. And the McKenzie friend was somebody you know from your NUJ days. It was Fiona O'Clery. She saw all this happen. So there was a journalist present, but nobody reported it. Nobody reported my petition, nothing.
What's happened to journalism? Because, I mean, this surely back in the, say, the 1970s or 80s, this would have been, I mean, I was looking at the, for example, the Amnesty report on the Ukrainian army using schools and hospitals as their military bases by Amnesty, and expecting, well, this should be top of the ITV BBC bulletins tonight. Of course, almost nothing at all.
Nope. And I, as a former soldier, I would have always suspected that because of they're facing the Russian army, because of the problems they're facing, this is what they would do anyway to try and discourage the Russians from attacking. So that didn't surprise me in the slightest. But in terms of what's not being reported, before I know it was after I got to the court, but stick with that. Anybody who objects to being spied on can go to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, and it doesn't cost. They don't have to put up thousands of pounds or anything. So, but I went in, no, I didn't. It was after that. I told an MP, I can't remember her name, and she persuaded me to send my stories in to the digital Culture and Media and Sports Committee, which look at these things. And the House of Commons has printed, wait for this, 56 pages of my evidence. That's never been reported by anybody.
I think maybe it's simply...
I don't know what you make of that. It may
be simply that people have just decided, well, there hasn't really been a public debate about this surveillance, but we know it's happening anyway, so what can we do about it? Nothing. It's just part of the technology we're using day to day. We know from the WikiLeaks Vault 7, for example, that our television can be used to monitor everything we say and what our children are chatting about with their friends, that our computer microphones, our phones, our location, our history of our searches, everything is out there, and there doesn't seem to be a lot being done to protect people at all, even though, of course, if you actually ask people for these things, they would say, no, I don't want to be under surveillance.
Well, quite. But here's the Guardian won the Pulitzer Prize for its reporting of Edward Snowden. And I just don't understand this. The Guardian never asked two questions. One was, is this happening here in the UK? And if it is, what is it? And the second question was, is this legal? The Guardian never followed up these two questions. So I did. And that's the only difference. I thought this is illegal, and I got the judges to agree with me. So great. And I got Parliament to agree. 56 pages. Not one word of it's ever been reported anywhere. So journalism is nothing if not arbitrary, is it? But to go... What the Guardian should have explained back in the day is, what are they doing with this data? Key question. If they're not doing anything with it, it doesn't matter much. It's irritating. But Microsoft and eight other companies are using the data to make records of every person who uses a phone. They then scan those records, and they manipulate the people who are in the records. In other words, this is not a kind of free thing. These people collect the data, and they use it to manipulate the victims, to manipulate them into having opinions they wouldn't otherwise have,
targeting stories at them, this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, but the bigger problem is that the manipulation is invisible. Obviously, I wouldn't know if I was being... An ordinary person would not know. The manipulation is group. They group a bunch of people and they say they've all got the same characteristics, so we'll push these things at them. Now, two of the things I think are happening because of this. One is the catastrophic rate of gun murders and gun suicides in the United States. The country most affected directly by this is the country in which the criminals are resident. 45,000 Americans were shot dead. 50% were suicide and 50% were homicide.
I mean, what's so worrying about this? I mean, you're talking really here about profiling and people in databases, in boxes, basically, to do with kind of a person they are. Now, two things come to mind immediately is it's extremely concerning that you might have a sort of database of 100,000 psychopaths, or you might have a database of 100,000 Jews, and then decide what you're going to do with those people.
That's one of the data they're most interested in is damaging data, vulnerabilities, people who are psychopaths. This is what they look for. And, of course, it would be very easy to line up the people who are Jewish, because you can pick it up really easily. But the big catastrophe, and America doesn't seem conscious of it, is that the scale of gun deaths in the United States is higher than in the worst of the Vietnam War. And nobody seems, you know, it's kind of, oh, that's just how things are. Well, it isn't. I have a suspicion, I reflected it to you in my thing, that the criminals, the big thing they're doing is in the United States against the American public. Mm. Do you ever remember McCultra?
MK Ultra?
Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yes, of course, yeah. Mind control.
Yeah. Well, this was the CIA spraying people in the street with LSD. And lots of people went bananas and people committed suicide. This was the effect, because you're walking along the street and you get a face full of LSD. Well, you obviously haven't a clue what's just happened to you. You're seeing a lot of bright lights. And a number of the people affected by McCultra, the McCultra experiment, committed suicide. And this looks like a digital McCultra experiment.
Interesting. So, I mean, yes, very psychedelic. But, I mean, MK Ultra was surely more about putting people through these kind of psychiatric hell, basically, in order to try and wipe their minds. This was the Ewan Cameron and his friend's basic idea was, let's try and just wipe their minds out, turn them into vegetables, and then we can rebuild them, you know, a bit like Steve Austin of the mind.
That was it. That was what McCultra was. But they were doing it physically till they got caught. Until, again, as happens, the American media picked it up. But the American media are completely stone dead on this one. They're not aware that if you've got a bunch of crooks in the NSA, National Security Agency, spying illegally and criminally on foreigners, you need to be quite sure they're not doing the same to you. And I believe they are.
So I don't quite see your link between MK Ultra and the, you know, this current surveillance, though. How do you see the two as linked?
The current surveillance creates databases, yeah, with your data, my data in them. And when they analyze that and say, we want to target, call it psychopaths, well, there's the list. They have a complete list of psychopaths, and they then start tweaking them. Remember, McCultra was essentially secret. People didn't know it was being done to them. And this is the same thing, except it's being done digitally.
Fascinating. Well, it'd be interesting to see how this court action goes, Kevin. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Whilst you're on, I'd love to get your take on the Conservative leadership challenge, because it does seem as if we're being given a choice, or the Conservative Party anyway, have been given a choice between the two aspects of Treasury policy, one which is embedded with Goldman Sachs, the other which is a sort of Foreign Office puppet who will say anything that is put on a teleprompter, an auto cue in front of her.
Rishi Sunak should have been understood from day one for what he was. A private banker, an offshore tax dodger, doing all the usual stuff that rich Tories do. And nobody picked him up on it. And now we've got Truss, who is, as you say, seems to be a complete idiot. You know, say, put something on the teleprompter and she says it. And she is a determined follower of Boris Johnson, who is a crook. I mean, how did we go through a period when our prime minister had been convicted by two different Supreme Courts for lying to the Queen and illegally closing Parliament? And he got away with it. He's not before any committee for those lying to the Queen. And he's not before any committee for having illegally charged, closed down Parliament. But she is his heir. And there's an interesting article by Andrew Neil in the Mail a couple of days ago. He's pro-trust. Andrew Neil is not objective. He's a Tory, always was, and nothing changes. And Andrew is sort of plugging Liz Truss and thinks she's going to be a great prime minister, but he's got a bit of advice for her. And one is to stop giving interviews. Yeah. Except to him, of course.
Well, but we might well see that, mightn't we? Of course, I mean, that's part of the deal, isn't it? It's a bit like Biden, you know, when he's running for president, he's happy to make all these pledges. Afterwards, it's all gone rather quiet when it comes to things like the most important piece of paper in the world called the Iran nuclear deal.
Yep. There's not been anything on that recently, and the Iranians seem to be getting more kind of confident that they can get away with it.
The obvious next question, Kevin, is what about Labour? Because it almost seems as if, I mean, Truss is clearly the favourite at the moment, but it's almost as if, well, if Boris was still in charge of the Conservative Party, he's so much more articulate and he would wipe the floor with Keir Starmer. Actually, what you've got is a kind of massive, like, levelling down, dumbing down operation going on with the desperate scrabble within the Tory party to find someone who's as incompetent as Keir Starmer to give Keir a chance at the next election.
Well, no, I don't think it's that simple. Keir Starmer is completely middle class, middle of the road, steady pair of hands. He's professional. He's about as unlike Johnson as you could get in a fit, and he's not charismatic. So he has a problem, having been faced with Johnson. But it's very difficult to level up when the guy before you was actually a crook, a liar, a cheat, and he got away with it. Almost, till even his own cabinet couldn't stand it. But Keir Starmer has real problems. But I think, like in America, Americans got frightened in the end by Trump. They were afraid he would start a nuclear war or something, and that's why they choose very uncharismatic 78-year-old Biden. I mean, Biden's far too old. But the Americans were frightened by Trump. And that wasn't ever picked up in the polls or anything, that the average middle American in Peoria, Illinois, thought this guy is dangerous. He might be very entertaining, but he's also very dangerous.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is, charisma plays a very important part. People want to feel that they've got somebody who can actually, you know, crack a quip or two and think for themselves in charge, rather than someone who's just going to read a script. Otherwise, you're just watching a kind of political drama unfolding with various actors on the stage. Anyway, look, what about trespassing earlier this week over in Berkshire at the estate of Richard Bennion, he's not a former MP, is he? He's actually...
he is a former MP, yep.
Access to the countryside or something. So what do you make of that? It's quite interesting. It's a lovely thing to do in the summer, is to go on a mass trespass, and members seem to have done a good job here.
Yeah, it made me feel very guilty, because I didn't realise how big his estate was. No, he was an MP for quite a while, and he's put into the House of Lords by Johnson, and now he's in charge of public access to land in England. And he has 13,000 acres in Surrey. Now, we had him in the rich list that, you know, 100 million-ish, because we didn't have any idea how big the estate was.
Oh, it's in Berkshire.
In Berkshire, rather. Sorry, did I say Surrey? In Englefield. It's just there by the river, just by Runnymede. In fact, he might even own Runnymede. But no, the estate covers that corner of the home counties. But whichever way, we thought he had a couple of thousand acres. We didn't know he had 13,000. That's a huge estate, even, you know, in a country full of big estates. The second thing was, if we had valued him properly, he'd have been up amongst the serious billionaires. Well, think of it, 13,000 acres of Berkshire, Surrey.
But how can the minister in charge of access to nature be stopping up footpaths? That's what he's been doing on his estate.
I mean, he's done that. But it made me think historically that the greatest crime in English history was the enclosures. That's where his estates came from. They were created during the enclosures.
Well, yes, okay, so we're seeing another enclosure happening now, in a way, a similar sort of what some call injustice, which is we've heard over the last few weeks that there are some serious moves now. Actually, this is all, though people didn't realise it, part of the climate legislation for livestock farmers to, I mean, there's been big protests about this in Holland. Livestock farmers are being told, actually, your livestock are very inefficient. We need to get rid of them. We need to replace them with things like trees, put those where the grass was, because obviously not all land can be used for growing crops. But rather than having livestock, we're now being told after 4,000 years or so of rearing livestock in Britain that it's the end and we're going to have lab-grown meat instead.
Well, I don't weep for farmers. The majority of farmers voted for Brexit, and it was, I could, you know, forget the kind of ideology and the principles. Most of the money going to British farmers was coming from Brussels.
Hang on, this is not really about
Britain. This was
this,
mad.
Because this is happening in Holland.
Yeah, but this is...
It looks like it may be coming here too soon.
No, it's still a fad. Agriculture is long-term stuff, and it takes time to change it. And if you want to make a change like that, you've got to do it slowly. And this kind of fadism, and that's what it is, it doesn't work. You wind up with the country very short of food.
What amazes me is there's been no public debate really about this. Do we want to get to end livestock and sheep farming? The other thing is, of course, they're really pretty much the only independent people in the food chain. The rest of the food chain is controlled by the big corporates. The only ones that don't
are
farmers that are just sort of growing lamb and beef, etc., on grassland, and they're the only people out of that corporate loop.
Can you imagine? Yesterday we drove through some of that farmland. You know, we could see the sheep and the cattle everywhere around us. But you could argue, if you were very cynical, that you con them over Brexit and then you take all their money away and then you take their cattle away. It's a con trick, but it's, at heart it's just fadism. Yeah, there is a problem.
What about the set aside? Because this is something which shocks me time and time again. Is the obviously back in medieval times, everyone knew you had to leave a three field system. You had to leave one of the fields fallow every year, so you had two to grow in, and then you rotated. This is the whole thing of crop rotation, and so we do need to. You know, we can't be using the land every single year intensively. It needs to have a bit of a rest. I think everyone understands that in the countryside, but we're now being told that, you know, this set aside can stay there for years and years. I think it's something like 6 or 7 years now that they're leaving, just paying farmers to do nothing with it still. And this surely is not going to help the cost of living crisis and the price of food.
But think of the other, add to that, that farmers are paid simply for owning land. Some people, the word farmer shouldn't be used, the word landowners should be used instead. A lot of landowners, including the Queen, are getting huge subsidies for doing nothing. You're calling it set aside, but that's only part of it. How much you get is measured by how much land you own. You know, that's it. That's what you put in your form. I own 13,000 acres, and you get set aside and do nothing with that land on that basis.
Okay, finally, Kevin, this cost of living crisis, we're just being told gas bills are going to go up on average to £4,500. I mean, it's a bit more than a crisis, isn't it? Because if you look at the profits that these energy companies are taking, it does seem to be more like profiteering and price fixing.
I mean, it's scandalous profiteering. And the government, I mean, the government has done nothing. You know, it's almost as if, well, it isn't almost. The government is on the side of the corporates, and they can apparently do no wrong, including ripping people off. I mean, what would BP's profits were the biggest they've ever had for years and years, and Shell and all the others. So why doesn't some of that money go back to the people who are going to be on the breadline?
Yeah, I mean, the argument seemed to be that people should be getting little paybacks from central government to help them with paying these bills. But it seems that, basically what's going on is this whole business of overcharging, profiteering, is not being dealt with at all.
Yeah, well, there are two problems. The right-wing press, and let's name the right-wing press, it's the whole Times Group, the Mail, the Telegraph, they're all owned by offshore tax dodgers. You know, how could you trust anything these people would say? They are not going to beat up the people, particularly the oil companies in which they hold shares. And they're not going to tell people you're being robbed, you're being ripped off. These are the serious, serious friends of the rip-off merchants. This is the Mail, the Sunday Times, and the Times, and the Sun. They all belong to offshore tax dodgers. So they speak for England, don't they?
Right. So where do we go to get some decent information then, decent news? The BBC?
The BBC is soggy. They're afraid of the government. So you must have, because you're a sharp journalist, that it's soggy. It has no edge. Yeah, they do some. They did that thing about the SAS murdering people in Afghanistan. They do have attacks of bravery, but the news is generally soggy, and it's generally, in effect, free. What they're reporting is what the government says and does.
I mean, I find they often seem to leave out the key part of a story. You know, so they'll talk about a strike, for example, without telling you actually what the strike's about, you know, quite often. Anyway, any final thoughts about the National Security Agency and what we can do about this mass surveillance, Kevin?
Well, I've picked a form of court action that doesn't cost me money, but it's free, and where the judges have already shown that they're highly sympathetic. Now, I've been there, and the judges said, yeah, you've got a case, lad. And in this case, of course, I have named the criminals, the guys in the National Security Agency, and the Chief Justice of the United States. First time that's ever happened. But here's the key to it, though. These are not my opinions. The Irish High Court and the European Court of Justice, which is a bigger Supreme Court than that of the United States, said that you are running a criminal court. This mass surveillance is being justified by American courts. And the court that applies here said, no, it's not even a court. It's not a court of law, and repudiated it. So that's my argument.
Yeah, but these courts are not really doing anything, are they? It's all very well for a very important court to make a decision, but it's got to act.
Well, this is the big, big issue. The court I went to made a decision. They invited the three key people, the police and the information commissioner, to act. And they all three of them refused in writing. Now, what do you do when somebody does that? But there's a bigger crime. The mass surveillance was sanctioned for a while by the European Commission, okay? This was despite the fact that the Irish Supreme Court had named the American spy who arranged this. The Irish Supreme Court actually put it in its judgment.
So who's that?
Have you seen? His name is Robert Litt. He was the chief legal man to James Clapper, the head of all the American intelligence systems before Trump. And have you ever seen that reported anywhere?
Well, over here, Kevin, there's quite a lot that gets reported only here. Anyway, look, Kevin Carhill, author of Who Owns Britain, former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and general troublemaker.
Yes.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony. Cheers.